Chapter 7. The Demon-Haunted World. There are demon-haunted worlds, regions of utter darkness. The Isa Upanishad, India, circa 600 BC. Fear of things invisible is the natural seed of that which everyone in himself calleth religion. Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan, 1651. The gods watch over us and guide our destinies, many human cultures teach. Other entities, more malevolent, are responsible for the existence of evil. Both classes of beings, whether considered natural or supernatural, real or imaginary, serve human needs. Even if they're wholly fanciful, people feel better believing in them. So, in an age when traditional religions have been under withering fire from science, is it not natural to wrap up the old gods and demons in scientific raiment and call them aliens? Belief in demons was widespread in the ancient world. They were thought of as natural rather than supernatural beings. Hesiod casually mentions them. Socrates described his philosophical inspiration as the work of a personal benign demon. His teacher, Diotima of Mantinea, tells him, in Plato's Symposium, that everything demonic is intermediate between God and mortal. God has no contact with man, she continues. Only through the demonic is there intercourse and conversation between man and gods, whether in the waking state or during sleep. Plato, Socrates' most celebrated student, assigned a high role to demons. No human nature invested with supreme power is able to order human affairs, he said, and not overflow with insolence and wrong. We do not appoint oxen to be the lords of oxen, or goats of goats, but we ourselves are a superior race and rule over them. In like manner, God, in his love of mankind, placed over us the demons, who are a superior race, and they, with great ease and pleasure to themselves, and no less to us, taking care of us and giving us peace and reverence and order and justice never failing, made the tribes of men happy and united. He stoutly denied that demons were a source of evil, and represented Eros, the keeper of sexual passions, as a demon, not a god, neither mortal nor immortal, neither good nor bad. But all later Platonists, including the Neoplatonists, who powerfully influenced Christian philosophy, held that some demons were good and others evil. The pendulum was swinging. Aristotle, Plato's famous student, seriously considered the contention that dreams are scripted by demons. Plutarch and Porphyry proposed that the demons who filled the upper air came from the moon. The early church fathers, despite having imbibed Neoplatonism from the culture they swam in, were anxious to separate themselves from pagan belief systems. They taught that all of pagan religion consisted of the worship of demons and men, both misconstrued as gods. When St. Paul complained, Ephesians 6:14, about wickedness in high places, he was referring not to government corruption, but to demons who lived in high places. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. From the beginning, much more was intended than demons as a mere poetic metaphor for the evil in the hearts of men. St. Augustine was much vexed with demons. He quotes the pagan thinking prevalent in his time. The gods occupy the loftiest regions, men the lowest, the demons the middle region. They have immortality of body, but passions of the mind in common with men. In Book 8 of the City of God, begun in 413, Augustine assimilates this ancient tradition, replaces gods by God, and demonizes the demons, arguing that they are, without exception, malign. They have no redeeming virtues. They are the fount of all spiritual and material evil. He calls them aerial animals most eager to inflict harm, utterly alien from righteousness, swollen with pride, pale with envy, subtle in deceit. They may profess to carry messages between God and man, disguising themselves as angels of the Lord, but this pose is a snare to lure us to our destruction. They can assume any form and know many things. Daemon means knowledge in Greek, especially about the material world. However intelligent, they are deficient in charity. They prey on the captive and outwitted minds of men, wrote Tertullian. They have their abode in the air, the stars are their neighbors, their commerce is with the clouds. In the 11th century, the influential Byzantine theologian, philosopher, and shady politician, Michael Psellus, described daemons in these words. These animals exist in our own life, which is full of passions, for they are present abundantly in the passions, and their dwelling place is that of matter, as is their rank and degree. For this reason, they are also subject to passions and fettered to them. One Recalmus, abbot of Schoenthal, around 1270, penned an entire treatise on daemons, rich in first-hand experience. He sees, but only when his eyes are shut, countless malevolent daemons, like motes of dust, buzzing around his head and everyone else's. Despite successive waves of rationalist Persian, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim worldviews, despite revolutionary social, political, and philosophical ferment, the existence, much of the character, and even the name of daemons remained unchanged from Hesiod through the Crusades. Daemons, the powers of the air, come down from the skies and have unlawful sexual congress with women. Augustine believed that witches were the offspring of these forbidden unions. In the Middle Ages, as in classical antiquity, nearly everyone believed such stories. The demons were also called devils or fallen angels. The demonic seducers of women were labeled incubi, of men, succubi. There are cases in which nuns reported, in some befuddlement, a striking resemblance between the incubus and the priest confessor, or the bishop, and awoke the next morning, as one 15th century chronicler put it, to find themselves polluted, just as if they had commingled with a man. There are similar accounts, but in harems, not convents, in ancient China. So many women reported incubi, argued the Presbyterian religious writer Richard Baxter in his Certainty of the World of Spirits, 1691, that 'tis impudence to deny it. As they seduced, the incubi and succubi were perceived as a weight bearing down on the chest of the dreamer. Mare, despite its Latin meaning, is the Old English word for incubus, and nightmare meant originally the demon that sits on the chests of sleepers, tormenting them with dreams. In Athanasius's Life of St. Antony, written around 360, demons are described as coming and going at will in locked rooms. 1400 years later, in his work De Daemonialitate, the Franciscan scholar, Ludovico Sinistrari, assures us that demons pass through walls. The external reality of demons was almost entirely unquestioned from antiquity through late medieval times. Maimonides denied their reality, but the overwhelming majority of rabbis believed in dibbuks. One of the few cases I can find where it is even hinted that demons might be internal, generated in our minds, is when Abba Poman, one of the desert fathers of the early church, was asked, "How do the demons fight against me?" "The demons fight against you?" Father Poman asked in turn. "Our own wills become the demons, and it is these which attack us." The medieval attitudes on incubi and succubi were influenced by Macrobius's 4th century commentary on the Dream of Scipio, which went through dozens of editions before the European Enlightenment. Macrobius described phantoms, phantasma, seen in the moment between wakefulness and slumber. The dreamer imagines the phantoms as predatory. Macrobius had a skeptical side, which his medieval readers tended to ignore. Obsession with demons began to reach a crescendo when, in his famous bull of 1484, Pope Innocent VIII declared, "It has come to our ears that members of both sexes do not avoid to have intercourse with evil angels, incubi and succubi, and that by their sorceries and by their incantations, charms, and conjurations, they suffocate, extinguish, and cause to perish the births of women, as well as generate numerous other calamities." With this bull, Innocent initiated the systematic accusation, torture, and execution of countless witches all over Europe. They were guilty of what Augustine had described as a criminal tampering with the unseen world. Despite the even-handed members of both sexes, in the language of the bull, unsurprisingly, it was mainly girls and women who were so persecuted. Many leading Protestants of the following centuries, their differences with the Catholic Church notwithstanding, adopted nearly identical views. Even humanists such as Desiderius Erasmus and Thomas More believed in witches. "The giving up of witchcraft," said John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, "is in effect the giving up of the Bible." William Blackstone, the celebrated jurist, in his Commentaries on the Laws of England, 1765, asserted, "To deny the possibility, nay, actual existence of witchcraft and sorcery, is at once flatly to contradict the revealed word of God in various passages of both the Old and New Testament." Innocent commended our dear sons Henry Cramer and James Sprenger, who have been by letters apostolic delegated as inquisitors of these heretical depravities. "If the abominations and enormities in question remain unpunished, the souls of multitudes face eternal damnation." The Pope appointed Cramer and Sprenger to write a comprehensive analysis, using the full academic armory of the late 15th century. With exhaustive citations of scripture and of ancient and modern scholars, they produced the Malleus Maleficarum, the Hammer of Witches, aptly described as one of the most terrifying documents in human history. Thomas Adie, in A Candle in the Dark, condemned it as villainous doctrines and inventions, horrible lies and impossibilities, serving to hide their unparalleled cruelty from the ears of the world. What the Malleus comes down to, pretty much, is that if you're accused of witchcraft, you're a witch. Torture is an unfailing means to demonstrate the validity of the accusation. There are no rights of the defendant. There's no opportunity to confront the accusers. Little attention is given to the possibility that accusations might be made for impious purposes. Jealousy, say, or revenge, or the greed of the inquisitors who routinely confiscated for their own private benefit the property of the accused. This technical manual for torturers also includes methods of punishment, tailored to release demons from the victim's body before the process kills her. The Malleus in hand, the Pope's encouragement guaranteed, inquisitors began springing up all over Europe. It quickly became an expense account scam. All costs of investigation, trial, and execution were borne by the accused or her relatives, down to per diems for the private detectives hired to spy on her, wine for her guards, banquets for her judges, the travel expenses of a messenger sent to fetch a more experienced torturer from another city, and the faggots, tar, and hangman's rope. Then there was a bonus to the members of the tribunal for each witch burned. The convicted witch's remaining property, if any, was divided between church and state. As this legally and morally sanctioned mass murder and theft became institutionalized, as a vast bureaucracy arose to serve it, attention was turned from poor hags and crones to the middle class and well-to-do of both sexes. The more who, under torture, confessed to witchcraft, the harder it was to maintain that the whole business was mere fantasy. Since each witch was made to implicate others, the numbers grew exponentially. These constituted frightful proofs that the devil is still alive, as it was later put in America in the Salem witch trials. In a credulous age, the most fantastic testimony was soberly accepted. That tens of thousands of witches had gathered for a Sabbath in public squares in France, or that 12,000 of them darkened the skies as they flew to Newfoundland. The Bible had counseled, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." Legions of women were burnt to death, and the most horrendous tortures were routinely applied to every defendant, young or old, after the instruments of torture were first blessed by the priests. Innocent himself died in 1492, following unsuccessful attempts to keep him alive by transfusion, which resulted in the deaths of three boys, and by suckling at the breast of a nursing mother. He was mourned by his mistress and their children. In Britain, witch finders, also called prickers, were employed, receiving a handsome bounty for each girl or woman they turned over for execution. They had no incentive to be cautious in their accusations. Typically, they looked for devil's marks, scars or birthmarks or nevi, that when pricked with a pin, neither hurt nor bled. A simple sleight of hand often gave the appearance that the pin penetrated deep into the witch's flesh. When no visible marks were apparent, invisible marks sufficed. Upon the gallows, one mid-17th century pricker confessed he had been the death of above 220 women in England and Scotland for the gain of 20 shillings apiece. In the witch trials, mitigating evidence or defense witnesses were inadmissible. In any case, it was nearly impossible to provide compelling alibis for accused witches. The rules of evidence had a special character. For example, in more than one case, a husband attested that his wife was asleep in his arms at the very moment she was accused of frolicking with the devil at a witch's Sabbath. But the archbishop patiently explained that a demon had taken the place of the wife. The husbands were not to imagine that their powers of perception could exceed Satan's powers of deception. The beautiful young women were perforce consigned to the flames. There were strong erotic and misogynistic elements, as might be expected in a sexually repressed, male-dominated society with inquisitors drawn from the class of nominally celibate priests. The trials paid close attention to the quality and quantity of orgasm in the supposed copulations of defendants with demons or the devil. Although Augustine had been certain we cannot call the devil a fornicator, and to the nature of the devil's member, cold by all reports. Devil's marks were found generally on the breasts or private parts, according to Ludovico Sinistrari's 1700 book. As a result, pubic hair was shaved, and the genitalia were carefully inspected by the exclusively male inquisitors. In the immolation of the 20-year-old Joan of Arc, after her dress had caught fire, the hangman of Rouen slaked the flames so onlookers could view all the secrets which can or should be in a woman. The chronicle of those who were consumed by fire in the single German city of Würzburg in the single year, 1598, penetrates these statistics and lets us confront a little of the human reality. The steward of the Senate named Göring, old Mrs. Kanzler, the tailor's fat wife, the woman cook of Mr. Mengerdorf, a stranger, a strange woman, Baunach, a senator, the fattest citizen in Würzburg, the old smith of the court, an old woman, a little girl, 9 or 10 years old, a younger girl, her little sister, the mother of the two little aforementioned girls, Liebler's daughter, Goebbels' child, the most beautiful girl in Würzburg, a student who knew many languages, two boys from the Minster, each 12 years old, Stepper's little daughter, the woman who kept the bridge gate, an old woman, the little son of the town council bailiff, the wife of Knertz the butcher, the infant daughter of Dr. Schultz, a blind girl, Schwartz Canon at Hach. On and on it goes. Some were given special humane attention. The little daughter of Valkenberger was privately executed and burnt. There were 28 public immolations, each with 4 to 6 victims on average, in that small city in a single year. This was a microcosm of what was happening all across Europe. No one knows how many were killed altogether. Perhaps hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions. Those responsible for prosecuting, torturing, judging, burning, and justifying were selfless. Just ask them. They could not be mistaken. The confessions of witchcraft could not be based on hallucinations, say, or desperate attempts to satisfy the inquisitors and stop the torture. In such a case, explained the witch judge Pierre de Lancre in his 1612 book, The Description of the Inconstancy of Evil Angels, the Catholic Church would be committing a great crime by burning witches. Those who raise such possibilities are thus attacking the Church and, ipso facto, committing a mortal sin. Critics of witch-burning were punished, and in some cases, themselves burned. The inquisitors and torturers were doing God's work. They were saving souls. They were foiling demons. Witchcraft, of course, was not the only offense that merited torture and burning at the stake. Heresy was a still more serious crime, and both Catholics and Protestants punished it ruthlessly. In the 16th century, the scholar William Tyndale had the temerity to contemplate translating the New Testament into English. But if people could actually read the Bible in their own language, instead of arcane Latin, they could form their own independent religious views. They might conceive of their own private, unintermediated line to God. This was a challenge to the job security of Roman Catholic priests. When Tyndale tried to publish his translation, he was hounded and pursued all over Europe. Eventually, he was captured, garrotted, and then, for good measure, burned at the stake. His copies of the New Testament, which a century later became the basis of the exquisite King James translation, were then hunted down house to house by armed posses. Christians piously defending Christianity by preventing other Christians from knowing the words of Christ. Such a cast of mind, such a climate of absolute confidence that knowledge should be rewarded by torture and death, were unlikely to help those accused of witchcraft. Burning witches is a feature of Western civilization that has, with occasional political exceptions, declined since the 16th century. In the last judicial execution of witches in England, a woman and her 9-year-old daughter were hanged. Their crime was raising a rainstorm by taking their stockings off. In our time, witches and djinns are found as regular fare in children's entertainment. Exorcism of demons is still practiced by the Roman Catholic and other churches, and the proponents of one cult still denounce as sorcery the cultic practices of another. We still use the word pandemonium, literally all demons. A crazed and violent person is still said to be demonic. Not until the 18th century was mental illness no longer generally ascribed to supernatural causes. Even insomnia had been considered a punishment inflicted by demons. More than half of Americans tell pollsters they believe in the devil's existence, and 10% have communicated with him, as Martin Luther reported he did regularly. In a 1992 spiritual warfare manual called Prepare for War, Rebecca Brown informs us that abortion and sex outside of marriage will almost always result in demonic infestation, that meditation, yoga, and martial arts are designed so unsuspecting Christians will be seduced into worshipping demons, and that rock music didn't just happen. It was a carefully masterminded plan by none other than Satan himself. Sometimes your loved ones are demonically bound and blinded. Demonology is today still part and parcel of many earnest faiths. And what is it that demons do? In the Malleus, Kramer and Sprenger reveal that devils busy themselves by interfering with the process of normal copulation and conception by obtaining human semen and themselves transferring it. Demonic artificial insemination in the Middle Ages goes back at least to St. Thomas Aquinas, who tells us in On the Trinity that demons can transfer the semen which they have collected and inject it into the bodies of others. His contemporary, St. Bonaventura, spells it out in a little more detail. Succubi yield to males and receive their semen. By cunning skill, the demons preserve its potency, and afterwards, with the permission of God, they become incubi and pour it out into female repositories. The products of these demon-mediated unions are also, when they grow up, visited by demons. A multi-generational, trans-species, sexual bond is forged. And these creatures, we recall, are well known to fly. Indeed, they inhabit the upper air. There is no spaceship in these stories, but most of the central elements of the alien abduction account are present, including sexually obsessive non-humans who live in the sky, walk through walls, communicate telepathically, and perform breeding experiments on the human species. Unless we believe that demons really exist, how can we understand so strange a belief system embraced by the whole Western world, including those considered the wisest among us, reinforced by personal experience in every generation, and taught by church and state? Is there any real alternative besides a shared delusion based on common brain wiring and chemistry? In Genesis, we read of angels who couple with the daughters of men. The culture myths of ancient Greece and Rome told of gods appearing to women as bulls or swans or showers of gold and impregnating them. In one early Christian tradition, philosophy derived not from human ingenuity, but out of demonic pillow talk, the fallen angels betraying the secrets of heaven to their human consorts. Accounts with similar elements appear in cultures around the world. Parallels to incubi include Arabian jinn, Greek satyrs, Hindu boots, Samoan hotuaporo, Celtic dusai, and many others. In an epoch of demon hysteria, it was easy enough to demonize those we feared or hated. So Merlin was said to have been fathered by an incubus. So were Plato, Alexander the Great, Augustus, and Martin Luther. Occasionally, an entire people, for example the Huns or the inhabitants of Cyprus, were accused by their enemies of having been sired by demons. In Talmudic tradition, the archetypal succubus was Lilith, whom God made from the dust along with Adam. She was expelled from Eden for insubordination, not to God, but to Adam. Ever since, she spends her nights seducing Adam's descendants. In ancient Iranian and many other cultures, nocturnal seminal emissions were believed to be elicited by succubi. Saint Teresa of Avila reported a vivid sexual encounter with an angel of light, not of darkness, she was sure, as did other women later sanctified by the Catholic Church. Cagliostro, the 18th century magician and con man, let it be understood that he, like Jesus of Nazareth, was a product of the union between the children of heaven and earth. In 1645, a Cornish teenager, Anne Jeffreys, was found groggy, crumpled on the floor. Much later, she recalled being attacked by a half a dozen little men, carried paralyzed to a castle in the air, seduced, and returned home. She called the little men fairies. For many pious Christians, as for the inquisitors of Joan of Arc, this was a distinction without difference. Fairies were demons, plain and simple. They returned to terrify and torment her. The next year, she was arrested for witchcraft. Fairies traditionally have magical powers and can cause paralysis by the merest touch. The ordinary passage of time is slowed in fairyland. Fairies are reproductively impaired, so they have sex with humans and carry off babies from their cradles, sometimes leaving a fairy substitute, a changeling. Now, it seems a fair question. If Anne Jeffreys had grown up in a culture touting aliens rather than fairies, and UFOs rather than castles in the air, would her story have been distinguishable in any significant respect from the ones abductees tell? In his 1982 book, The Terror That Comes in the Night, an experience-centered study of supernatural assault traditions, David Hufford describes an executive, university-educated, in his mid-30s, who recalled a summer spent as a teenager in his aunt's house. One night, he saw mysterious lights moving in the harbor. Afterwards, he fell asleep. From his bed, he then witnessed a white glowing figure climbing the stairs. She entered his room, paused, and then said, anticlimactically, it seems to me, "That is the linoleum." Some nights the figure was an old woman, in others an elephant. Sometimes the young man was convinced the entire business was a dream, other times he was certain he was awake. He was pressed down into his bed, paralyzed, unable to move or cry out. His heart was pounding. He was short of breath. Similar events transpired on many consecutive nights. What is happening here? These events took place before alien abductions were widely described. If the young man had known about alien abductions, would his old woman have had a larger head and bigger eyes? In several famous passages in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Edward Gibbon described the balance between credulity and skepticism in late classical antiquity. Credulity performed the office of faith. Fanaticism was permitted to assume the language of inspiration, and the effects of accident or contrivance were ascribed to supernatural causes. In modern times, Gibbon is writing in the middle 18th century, a latent and even involuntary skepticism adheres to the most pious dispositions. Their admission of supernatural truths is much less an active consent than a cold and passive acquiescence. Accustomed long since to observe and to respect the invariable order of nature, our reason, or at least our imagination, is not sufficiently prepared to sustain the visible action of the deity. But in the first ages of Christianity, the situation of mankind was extremely different. The most curious or the most credulous among the pagans were often persuaded to enter into a society which asserted an actual claim of miraculous powers. The primitive Christians perpetually trod on mystic ground, and their minds were exercised by the habits of believing the most extraordinary events. They felt, or they fancied, that on every side they were incessantly assaulted by demons, comforted by visions, instructed by prophecy, and surprisingly delivered from danger, sickness, and from death itself by the supplications of the church. It was their firm persuasion that the air which they breathed was peopled with invisible enemies, with innumerable demons who watched every occasion and assumed every form, to terrify and above all to tempt their unguarded virtue. The imagination and even the senses were deceived by the illusions of distempered fanaticism. And the hermit, whose midnight prayer was oppressed by involuntary slumber, might easily confound the phantoms of horror or delight which had occupied his sleeping and his waking dreams. The practice of superstition is so congenial to the multitude that if they are forcibly awakened, they still regret the loss of their pleasing vision. Their love of the marvelous and supernatural, their curiosity with regard to future events, and their strong propensity to extend their hopes and fears beyond the limits of the visible world, were the principal causes which favored the establishment of polytheism. So urgent on the vulgar is the necessity of believing that the fall of any system of mythology will most probably be succeeded by the introduction of some other mode of superstition. Put aside Gibbon's social snobbery, the devil tormented the upper classes too, and even a king of England. James I, the first Stuart monarch, wrote a credulous and superstitious book on demons, Demonology, 1597. He also was the patron of the great translation of the Bible into English that still bears his name. It was King James's opinion that tobacco is the devil's weed, and a number of witches were exposed through their addiction to this drug. But by 1618, James had become a thoroughgoing skeptic, mainly because adolescents had been found faking demonic possession, in which state they had accused innocent people of witchcraft. If we reckon the skepticism that Gibbon says characterized his time to have declined in ours, and if even a little of the rampant gullibility he attributes to late classical times is left over in ours, should we not expect something like demons to find a niche in the popular culture of the present? Of course, as enthusiasts for extraterrestrial visitations are quick to remind me, there's another interpretation of these historical parallels. Aliens, they say, have always been visiting us, poking at us, stealing our sperms and eggs, impregnating us. In earlier times, we recognized them as gods, demons, fairies, or spirits. Only now do we understand that it's aliens who have been diddling us all these millennia. Jacques Vallée has made such arguments. But then, why are there virtually no reports of flying saucers prior to 1947? Why is it that none of the world's major religions uses saucers as icons of the divine? Why no warnings about the dangers of high technology then? Why isn't this genetic experiment, whatever its objective, completed by now, thousands of years or more after its initiation by beings supposedly of vastly superior technological attainments? Why are we in such trouble if the breeding program is designed to improve our lot? Following this line of argument, we might anticipate present adherents of the old beliefs to understand aliens to be fairies, gods, or demons. In fact, there are several contemporary sects, the Raelians, for example, that hold gods or God to come to Earth in UFOs. Some abductees describe the aliens, however repulsive, as angels or emissaries of God, and there are those who still think it's demons. In Whitley Strieber's Communion, a first-hand account of alien abduction, the author relates, "Whatever was there seemed so monstrously ugly, so filthy and dark and sinister. Of course they were demons. They had to be. I still remember that thing crouching there, so terribly ugly, its arms and legs like the limbs of a great insect, its eyes glaring at me." Reportedly, Strieber is now open to the possibility that these nighttime terrors were dreams or hallucinations. Articles on UFOs in the Christian News Encyclopedia, a fundamentalist compilation, include Unchristian Fanatic Obsession and Scientists Believes UFOs Work of Devil. The Spiritual Counterfeits Project of Berkeley, California, teaches that UFOs are of demonic origin. The Aquarian Church of Universal Service of McMinnville, Oregon, that all aliens are hostile. A 1993 newsletter of Cosmic Awareness Communications informs us that UFO occupants think of humans as laboratory animals, wish us to worship them, but tend to be deterred by the Lord's Prayer. Some abductees have been cast out of their evangelical religious congregations. Their stories sound too close to Satanism. A 1980 fundamentalist tract, The Cult Explosion, by Dave Hunt, reveals that UFOs are clearly not physical and seem to be demonic manifestations from another dimension, calculated to alter man's way of thinking. The alleged UFO entities that have presumably communicated psychically with humans have always preached the same four lies that the serpent introduced to Eve. These beings are demons, and they are preparing for the Antichrist. A number of sects hold UFOs and alien abductions to be premonitions of end times. If UFOs come from another planet or another dimension, were they sent by the same God who has been revealed to us in any of the major religions? Nothing in the UFO phenomena, the fundamentalist complaint goes, requires belief in the one true God, while much in it contradicts the God portrayed in the Bible and Christian tradition. The New Age, a Christian critique by Ralph Rath, 1990, discusses UFOs, typically for such literature, with extreme credulity. It serves their purpose to accept UFOs as real and revile them as instruments of Satan and the Antichrist, rather than to use the blade of scientific skepticism. That tool, once honed, might accomplish more than just a limited heresiotomy. The Christian fundamentalist author Hal Lindsey, in his 1994 religious bestseller Planet Earth, 2000 AD, writes, "I have become thoroughly convinced that UFOs are real. They are operated by alien beings of great intelligence and power. I believe these beings are not only extraterrestrial, but supernatural in origin. To be blunt, I think they are demons, part of a satanic plot." And what is the evidence for this conclusion? Chiefly, it is the 11th and 12th verses of Luke chapter 21, in which Jesus talks about great signs from heaven. Nothing like a UFO is described in the last days. Typically, Lindsay ignores verse 32, in which Jesus makes it very clear he is talking about events in the first, not the 20th century. There is also a Christian tradition, according to which extraterrestrial life cannot exist. In Christian News for May 23, 1994, for example, W. Gary Crampton, Doctor of Theology, tells us why. The Bible, either explicitly or implicitly, speaks to every area of life. It never leaves us without an answer. The Bible nowhere explicitly affirms or negates intelligent extraterrestrial life. Implicitly, however, Scripture does deny the existence of such beings, thus also negating the possibility of flying saucers. Scripture views Earth as the center of the universe. According to Peter, a planet-hopping savior is out of the question. Here is an answer to intelligent life on other planets. If there were such, who would redeem them? Certainly not Christ. Experiences which are out of line with the teachings of Scripture must always be renounced as fallacious. The Bible has a monopoly on the truth. But many other Christian sects, Roman Catholics for example, are completely open-minded, with no a priori objections to and no insistence on the reality of aliens and UFOs. In the early 1960s, I argued that the UFO stories were crafted chiefly to satisfy religious longings. At a time when science has complicated uncritical adherence to the old-time religions, an alternative is proffered to the God hypothesis. Dressed in scientific jargon, their immense powers explained by superficially scientific terminology, the gods and demons of old come down from heaven to haunt us, to offer prophetic visions, and to tantalize us with visions of a more hopeful future. A space-age mystery religion aborning. The folklorist Thomas E. Bullard wrote in 1989 that abduction reports sound like rewrites of older supernatural encounter traditions, with aliens serving the functional roles of divine beings. He concludes, science may have evicted ghosts and witches from our beliefs, but it just as quickly filled the vacancy with aliens having the same functions. Only the extraterrestrial outer trappings are new. All the fear and the psychological dramas for dealing with it seem simply to have found their way home again, where it is business as usual in the legend realm where things go bump in the night. Is it possible that people in all times and places occasionally experience vivid, realistic hallucinations, often with sexual content, about abduction by strange, telepathic, aerial creatures who ooze through walls, with the details filled in by the prevailing cultural idioms, sucked out of the zeitgeist? Others, who have not personally had the experience, find it stirring and, in a way, familiar. They pass the story on. Soon it takes on a life of its own, inspires others trying to understand their own visions and hallucinations, and enters the realm of folklore, myth, and legend. The connection between the content of spontaneous temporal lobe hallucinations and the alien abduction paradigm is consistent with such a hypothesis. Perhaps when everyone knows that gods come down to Earth, we hallucinate gods. When all of us are familiar with demons, it's incubi and succubi. When fairies are widely accepted, we see fairies. In an age of spiritualism, we encounter spirits, and when the old myths fade and we begin thinking that extraterrestrial beings are plausible, then that's where our hypnagogic imagery tends. Snatches of song, or foreign languages, images, events that we witnessed, stories that we overheard in childhood, can be accurately recalled decades later without any conscious memory of how they got into our heads. In violent fervors, men, all ignorance, have talked in ancient tongues, says Herman Melville in Moby Dick. And, when the mystery is probed, it turns out always that in their wholly forgotten childhood, those ancient tongues had been really spoken in their hearing. In our everyday life, we effortlessly and unconsciously incorporate cultural norms and make them our own. A similar inhaling of motifs is present in schizophrenic command hallucinations. Here, people feel they are being told what to do by an imposing or mythic figure. They are ordered to assassinate a political leader or a folk hero, or defeat the British invaders, or harm themselves because it is the wish of God or Jesus or the devil or demons or angels or lately aliens. The schizophrenic is transfixed by a clear and powerful command from a voice that no one else can hear, and that the subject must somehow identify. Who would issue such a command? Who could speak inside our heads? The culture in which we've been raised offers up an answer. Think of the power of repetitive imagery in advertising, especially to suggestible viewers and readers. It can make us believe almost anything, even that smoking cigarettes is cool. In our time, putative aliens are the subject of innumerable science fiction stories, novels, TV dramas, and films. UFOs are a regular feature of the weekly tabloids, devoted to falsification and mystification. One of the highest-grossing motion pictures of all time is about aliens, very like those described by abductees. Alien abduction accounts were comparatively rare until 1975, when a credulous television dramatization of the Hill case was aired. Another leap into public prominence occurred after 1987, when Stryber's purported first-hand account with a haunting cover painting of a large-eyed alien became a bestseller. In contrast, we hear very little lately about incubi, elves, and fairies. Where have they all gone? Far from being global, such alien abduction stories are disappointingly local. The vast majority emanate from North America. They hardly transcend American culture. In other countries, bird-headed, insect-headed, reptilian, robot, and blonde and blue-eyed aliens are reported. The last, predictably, from Northern Europe. Each group of aliens is said to behave differently. Clearly, cultural factors are playing an important role. Long before the terms flying saucer or UFOs were invented, science fiction was replete with little green men and bug-eyed monsters. Somehow, small, hairless beings with big heads and eyes have been our staple aliens for a long time. You could see them routinely in the science fiction pulp magazines of the 20s and 30s, and, for example, in an illustration of a Martian sending radio messages to Earth in the December 1937 issue of the magazine Shortwave and Television. It goes back, perhaps, to our remote descendants, as depicted by the British science fiction pioneer H.G. Wells. Wells argued that humans evolved from smaller-brained but hairier primates, with an athleticism far exceeding that of Victorian academics. Extrapolating this trend far into the future, he suggested that our descendants should be nearly hairless, with immense heads, although barely able to walk around on their own. Advanced beings from other worlds might be similarly endowed. The typical modern extraterrestrial reported in America in the 80s and early 90s is small, with disproportionately large head and eyes, undeveloped facial features, no visible eyebrows or genitals, and smooth grey skin. It looks to me eerily like a fetus in roughly the 12th week of pregnancy, or a starving child. Why so many of us might be obsessing on fetuses or malnourished children and imagining them attacking and sexually manipulating us is an interesting question. In recent years in America, aliens different from the short grey motif have been on the rise. One psychotherapist, Richard Boylan of Sacramento, says, "You've got 3.5 foot to 4 foot types, you've got 5 to 6 foot types, you've got 7 to 8 foot types, you've got 3, 4, and 5 finger types, pads on the ends of fingers, or suction cups. You've got webbed or non-webbed fingers. You've got large, almond-shaped eyes slanted upward, outward, or horizontally. in some cases large ovoid eyes without the almond slant. You've got extraterrestrials with slit pupils. You've got other different body types, the so-called praying mantis type, the reptoid types. These are the ones I keep getting recurrently. There are a few exotic and single case reports that I tend to be a little cautious about until I get a lot more corroborative. Despite this apparent variety of extraterrestrials, the UFO abduction syndrome portrays, it seems to me, a banal universe. The form of the supposed aliens is marked by a failure of the imagination and a preoccupation with human concerns. Not a single being presented in all these accounts is as astonishing as a cockatoo would be if you had never before beheld a bird. Any protozoology or bacteriology or mycology textbook is filled with wonders that far outshine the most exotic descriptions of the alien abductionists. The believers take the common elements in their stories as tokens of verisimilitude, rather than as evidence that they have contrived their stories out of a shared culture and biology. Chapter 8. On the Distinction Between True and False Visions. A credulous mind finds most delight in believing strange things, and the stranger they are, the easier they pass with him, but never regards those that are plain and feasible, for every man can believe such. Samuel Butler, Characters, 1667 to 1669. For just an instant, I sense an apparition in the darkened room. Could it be a ghost? Or there's a flicker of motion. I see it out of the corner of my eye. But when I turn my head, there's nothing there. Is that a telephone ringing? Or is it just my imagination? In astonishment, I seem to be smelling the salt air of the Coney Island summer seashore of my childhood. I turn a corner in the foreign city I am visiting for the first time, and before me is a street so familiar I feel I've known it all my life. In these commonplace experiences, we're generally unsure what to do next. Were my eyes, or ears, or nose, or memory playing tricks on me? Or did I really and truly witness something out of the ordinary course of nature? Shall I keep quiet about it? Or shall I tell? The answer depends very much on my environment, friends, loved ones, and culture. In an obsessively rigid, practically oriented society, perhaps I would be cautious about admitting to such experiences. They might mark me as flighty, unsound, unreliable. But in a society that readily believes in ghosts, say, or a porting, accounts of such experiences might gain approval, even prestige. In the former, I would be sorely tempted to suppress the thing altogether. In the latter, maybe even to exaggerate or elaborate just a little to make it even more miraculous than it seemed. Charles Dickens, who lived in a flourishing, rational culture in which, however, spiritualism was also thriving, described the dilemma in these words from his short story, To Be Taken with a Grain of Salt. I have always noticed a prevalent want of courage, even among persons of superior intelligence and culture, as to imparting their own psychological experiences when those have been of a strange sort. Almost all men are afraid that what they could relate in such wise would find no parallel or response in a listener's internal life, and might be suspected or laughed at. A truthful traveller, who should have seen some extraordinary creature in the likeness of a sea serpent, would have no fear of mentioning it. But the same traveller, having had some singular presentiment, impulse, vagary of thought, vision, so-called, dream, or other remarkable mental impression, would hesitate considerably before he would own to it. To this reticence I attribute much of the obscurity in which such subjects are involved. In our time, there is still much dismissive chortling and ridicule. But the reticence in obscurity is more readily overcome, for example, in a supportive setting provided by a therapist or a hypnotist. Unfortunately, and for some people unbelievably, The distinction between imagination and memory is often blurred. Some abductees say they remember the experience without hypnosis. Many do not. But hypnosis is an unreliable way to refresh memory. It often elicits imagination, fantasy, and play, as well as true recollections, with neither patient nor therapist able to distinguish the one from the other. Hypnosis seems to involve, in a central way, a state of heightened suggestibility. Courts have banned its use as evidence or even as a tool of criminal investigation. The American Medical Association calls memories surfacing under hypnosis less reliable than those recalled without it. A standard medical school text, Harold I. Kaplan, Comprehensive Textbook of Psychiatry, 1989, warns of a high likelihood that the beliefs of the hypnotist will be communicated to the patient and incorporated into what the patient believes to be memories, often with strong conviction. So the fact that, when hypnotized, people sometimes relate alien abduction stories carries little weight. There's a danger that subjects are, at least on some matters, so eager to please the hypnotist that they sometimes respond to subtle cues of which even the hypnotist is unaware. In a study by Alvin Lawson of California State University, Long Beach, 8 subjects, pre-screened to eliminate UFO buffs, were hypnotized by a physician and informed that they had been abducted, brought to a spaceship, and examined. With no further prompting, they were asked to describe the experience. Their accounts, most of which were easily elicited, were almost indistinguishable from the accounts that self-described abductees present. True, Lawson had cued his subjects briefly and directly, but in many cases, the therapists who routinely deal with alien abductions cue their subjects, some in great detail, others more subtly and indirectly. The psychiatrist George Ganaway, as related by Lawrence Wright, once proposed to a highly suggestible patient under hypnosis that 5 hours were missing from her memory of a certain day. When he mentioned a bright light overhead, she promptly told him about UFOs and aliens. When he insisted she had been experimented on, a detailed abduction story emerged. But when she came out of the trance and examined a video of the session, she recognized that something like a dream had been caught surfacing. Over the next year, though, she repeatedly flashed back to the dream material. The University of Washington psychologist, Elizabeth Loftus, has found that unhypnotized subjects can easily be made to believe they saw something they didn't. In a typical experiment, subjects will view a film of a car accident. In the course of being questioned about what they saw, they're casually given false information. For example, a stop sign is offhandedly referred to, although there wasn't one in the film. Many subjects then dutifully recall seeing a stop sign. When the deception is revealed, some vehemently protest, stressing how vividly they remember the sign. The greater the time lag between viewing the film and being given the false information, the more people allow their memories to be tampered with. Loftus argues that memories of an event more closely resemble a story undergoing constant revision than a packet of pristine information. There are many other examples, some in spurious memory of being lost as a child in a shopping mall, for instance, of greater emotional impact. Once the key idea is suggested, the patient often plausibly fleshes out the supporting details. Lucid but wholly false recollections can easily be induced by a few cues and questions, especially in the therapeutic setting. Memory can be contaminated. False memories can be implanted even in minds that do not consider themselves vulnerable and uncritical. Stephen Cece of Cornell University Loftus and their colleagues have found, unsurprisingly, that preschoolers are exceptionally vulnerable to suggestion. The child who, when first asked, correctly denies having caught his hand in a mousetrap, later remembers the event in vivid, self-generated detail. When more directly told about some things that happened to you when you were little, over time, they easily enough assent to the implanted memories. Professionals watching videotapes of the children can do no better than chance in distinguishing false memories from true ones, Is there any reason to think that adults are wholly immune to the fallibilities exhibited by children? President Ronald Reagan, who spent World War II in Hollywood, vividly described his own role in liberating Nazi concentration camp victims. Living in the film world, he apparently confused a movie he had seen with a reality he had not. On many occasions in his presidential campaigns, Mr. Reagan told an epic story of World War II courage and sacrifice, an inspiration for all of us. Only, it never happened. It was the plot of the movie A Wing and a Prayer. That made quite an impression on me too when I saw it at age 9. Many other instances of this sort can be found in Reagan's public statements. It is not hard to imagine serious public dangers emerging out of instances in which political, military, scientific, or religious leaders are unable to distinguish fact from vivid fiction. In preparing for courtroom testimony, witnesses are coached by their lawyers. Often, they are made to repeat the story over and over again until they get it right. Then, on the stand, what they remember is the story they've been telling in the lawyer's office. The nuances have been shaded, or it may no longer correspond, even in its major features, to what really happened. Conveniently, the witnesses may have forgotten that their memories were reprocessed. These facts are relevant in evaluating the social effects of advertising and of national propaganda. But here they suggest that on alien abduction matters, where interviews typically take place years after the alleged event, therapists must be very careful that they do not accidentally implant or select the stories they elicit. Perhaps what we actually remember is a set of memory fragments stitched on a fabric of our own devising. If we sew cleverly enough, we have made ourselves a memorable story easy to recall. Fragments by themselves, unencumbered by association, are harder to retrieve. The situation is rather like the method of science itself, where many isolated data points can be remembered, summarized, and explained in the framework of a theory. We then much more easily recall the theory and not the data. In science, the theories are always being reassessed and confronted with new facts. If the facts are seriously discordant, beyond the error bars, the theory may have to be revised. But in everyday life, it is very rare that we are confronted with new facts about events of long ago. Our memories are almost never challenged. They can instead be frozen in place, no matter how flawed they are, or become a work in continual artistic revision. More than gods and demons, the best attested apparitions are those of saints, especially the Virgin Mary in Western Europe from late medieval to modern times. While alien abduction stories have much more the flavor of profane, demonic apparitions, insight into the UFO myth can also be gained from visions described as sacred. Perhaps best known are those of Jeanne d'Arc in France, St. Bridget in Sweden, and Girolamo Savonarola in Italy. But more appropriate for our purpose are the apparitions seen by shepherds and peasants and children. In a world plagued by uncertainty and horror, these people longed for contact with the divine. A detailed record of such events in Castile and Catalonia is provided by William A. Christian Jr. in his book, Apparitions in Late Medieval and Renaissance Spain, Princeton University Press, 1981. In a typical case, a rural woman or child reports encountering a girl or an oddly tiny woman, perhaps 3 or 4 feet tall, who reveals herself to be the Virgin Mary, the Mother of God. She requests the awestruck witness to go to the village fathers or the local church authorities and order them to say prayers for the dead, or obey the commandments, or build a shrine at this very spot in the countryside. If they do not comply, dire penalties are threatened, perhaps the plague. Alternatively, in plague-infested times, Mary promises to cure the disease, but only if her request is satisfied. The witness tries to do as she is told, but when she informs her father, or husband, or priest, she is ordered to repeat the story to no one. It is mere female foolishness, or frivolity, or demonic hallucination. So she keeps quiet. Days later, she is confronted again by Mary, a little put out that her request has not been honored. "They will not believe me," the witness complains. "Give me a sign. Evidence is needed." So Mary, who seems to have had no foreknowledge that evidence would have to be provided, provides a sign. The villagers and priests are promptly convinced. The shrine is built, miraculous cures occur within its vicinity, pilgrims come from far and wide, priests are busy, the economy of the region booms, the original witness is appointed keeper of the sacred shrine. In most of the cases we know of, there was a commission of inquiry, comprised of leaders, civic and ecclesiastic, who attested to the genuineness of the apparition, despite initial, almost exclusively male skepticism. But the standards of evidence were not generally high. In one case, the testimony of a delirious 8-year-old boy, taken 2 days before his death from plague, was soberly accepted. Some of these commissions deliberated decades or even a century after the event. In On the Distinction Between True and False Visions, an expert on the subject, Jean Gerson, in around 1400, summarized the criteria for recognizing a credible witness of an apparition. One was the willingness to accept advice from the political and religious hierarchy. Thus, anyone seeing a vision, disturbing to those in power, was ipso facto an unreliable witness, and saints and virgins could be made to say whatever the authorities wanted to hear. The signs allegedly provided by Mary, the evidence offered and considered compelling, included an ordinary candle, a piece of silk, and a magnetic stone, a piece of colored tile, footprints, the witness's unusually quick gathering of thistles, a simple wooden cross inserted in the ground, welts and wounds on the witness, and a variety of contortions. A 12-year-old with her hand held funny, or legs folded back, or a closed mouth making her temporarily mute. That are cured the moment her story is accepted. In some cases, accounts may have been compared and coordinated before testimony was given. For example, multiple witnesses in a small town might tell of a tall, glowing woman dressed all in white, carrying an infant son, and surrounded by a radiance that lit up the street the previous night. But in other cases, people standing directly beside the witness could see nothing, as in this report of a 1617 apparition from Castile. "A Bartolome, the lady who came to me these past days, is coming through the meadow, and she is kneeling and embracing the cross there. Look at her, look at her." The youth, though he looked as hard as he could, saw nothing except some small birds flying around above the cross. Possible motives for inventing and accepting such stories are not hard to find. Jobs for priests, notaries, carpenters, and merchants, and other boosts to the regional economy in a time of depression. Augmented social status of the witness and her family. Prayers once again offered for relatives buried in graveyards later abandoned because of plague. Drought and war. Rousing public spirit against enemies, especially Moors. Improving civility and obedience to canon law, and confirming the faith of the pious. The fervor of pilgrims in such shrines was impressive. It was not uncommon for rock scrapings or dirt from the shrine to be mixed with water and drunk as medicine. But I'm not suggesting that most witnesses made the whole business up. Something else was going on. Almost all the urgent requests by Mary were remarkable for their prosaicness. For example, in this 1483 apparition from Catalonia. "I charge you by your soul to charge the souls of the men of the parishes of El Torn, Mileras, El Salent, and San Miquel de Campmayor, to charge the souls of the priests to ask the people to pay up the tithes and all the duties of the church, and restore other things that they hold covertly or openly, which are not theirs, to their rightful owners within 30 days, for it will be necessary, and observe well the Holy Sunday. And second, that they should cease and desist from blaspheming, and they should pay the usual charitas mandated by their dead ancestors." Often the apparition is seen just after the witness awakes. Francisca La Brava testified in 1523 that she had gotten out of bed without knowing if she was in control of her senses, although in later testimony she claimed to be fully awake. This was in response to a question which allowed a gradation of possibilities: fully awake, dozing, in a trance, asleep. Sometimes details are wholly missing, such as what the accompanying angels look like, or Mary is described as both tall and short, both mother and child, characteristics that unmistakably suggest themselves as dream material. In the Dialogue of Miracles, written around 1223 by Caesarius of Heisterbach, clerical visions of the Virgin Mary often occurred during matins, which took place at the sleepy midnight hour. It is natural to suspect that many, perhaps all, of these apparitions were a species of dream, waking or sleeping, compounded by hoaxes and by forgeries. There was a thriving business in contrived miracles, religious paintings, and statues dug up by accident or divine command. The matter was addressed in the Siete Partidas, the Codex of Canon and Civil Law compiled under the direction of Alfonso the Wise, King of Castile, around 1248. In it, we can read the following. Some men fraudulently discover or build altars in fields or in towns, saying that they are relics of certain saints in those places, and pretending that they perform miracles. And for this reason, people from many places are induced to go there as on a pilgrimage, in order to take something away from them. And there are others who, influenced by dreams or empty phantoms which appear to them, erect altars and pretend to discover them in the above-named localities. In listing the reason for erroneous beliefs, Alfonso lays out a continuum from sect, opinion, fantasy, and dream to hallucination. A kind of fantasy named antoyanza is defined as follows. Antoyanza is something that stops before the eyes and then disappears, as one sees or hears it in a trance, and so is without substance. A 1517 papal bull distinguishes between apparitions that appear in dreams or divinely. Clearly, the secular and ecclesiastical authorities, even in times of extreme credulity, were alert to the possibilities of hoax and delusion. Nevertheless, in most of medieval Europe, such apparitions were greeted warmly by the Roman Catholic clergy, especially because the Marian admonitions were so congenial to the priesthood. A pathetic few signs of evidence, a stone or a footprint, and never anything unfakeable sufficed. But beginning in the 15th century, around the time of the Protestant Reformation, the attitude of the Church changed. Those who reported an independent channel to heaven were outflanking the Church's chain of command up to God. Moreover, a few of the apparitions, Jeanne d'Arc's for example, had awkward political or moral implications. The perils represented by Jeanne d'Arc's visions were described by her inquisitors in 1431 in these words. The great danger was shown to her that comes of someone so presumptuous to believe they have such apparitions and revelations, and therefore lie about matters concerning God, giving out false prophecies and divinations not known from God, but invented, from which could follow the seduction of peoples, the inception of new sects, and many other impieties that subvert the Church and Catholics. Both Jeanne d'Arc and Girolamo Savonarola were burnt at the stake for their visions. In 1516, the Fifth Lateran Council reserved to the Apostolic Seat the right to examine the authenticity of apparitions. For poor peasants, whose visions had no political content, the punishments fell short of the ultimate severity. The Marian apparition seen by Francisca La Brava, a young mother, was described by Licenciado Mariana, the Lord Inquisitor, as to the detriment of our holy Catholic faith and to the diminution of its authority. Her apparition was all vanity and frivolity. By rights, we could have treated her more rigorously, the Inquisitor continued. But in deference to certain just reasons that move us to mitigate the rigor of the sentences we decree as a punishment to Francisca Labrava, and an example to others not to attempt similar things, that we condemn her to be put on an ass and given 100 lashes in public through the accustomed streets of Belmonte, naked from the waist up, and the same number in the town of El Quintanar in the same manner. And that from now on, she not say or affirm in public or secretly by word or insinuation the things she said in her confessions, or else she will be prosecuted as an impenitent and one who does not believe in or agree with what is in our holy Catholic faith. Despite the penalties, it is striking how often the witness stuck to her guns and, ignoring the encouragements offered her to confess that she was lying or dreaming or confused, insisted that she really and truly had seen the vision. In a time when nearly everyone was illiterate, before newspapers, radio, and television, how could the religious and iconographic detail of these apparitions have been so similar? William Christian believes there is a ready answer in cathedral dramaturgy, especially Christmas plays, in itinerant preachers and pilgrims, and in church sermons. Legends about nearby shrines spread quickly. People sometimes came from 100 miles or more so that, say, their sick child could be cured by a pebble that had been trodden on by the Mother of God. Legends influence apparitions and vice versa. In a time haunted by drought, plague, and war, with no social or medical services available to the average person, with public literacy and the scientific method unheard of, skeptical thinking was rare. Why are the admonitions so prosaic? Why is a vision of so illustrious a personage as the Mother of God necessary, so in a tiny county populated by a few thousand souls, a shrine will be repaired or the populace will refrain from cursing? Why not important and prophetic messages whose significance could be recognized in later years as something that could have emanated only from God or the saints? Wouldn't this have greatly enhanced the Catholic cause in its mortal struggle with Protestantism and the Enlightenment? But we have no apparitions cautioning the Church against, say, accepting the delusion of an earth-centered universe, or warning it of complicity with Nazi Germany, two matters of considerable moral as well as historical import on which Pope John Paul II, to his credit, has admitted that the Church has erred. Not a single saint criticized the practice of torturing and burning witches and heretics. Why not? Were they unaware of what was going on? Could they not grasp its evil? And why is Mary always ordering the poor peasant to inform the authorities? Why doesn't she admonish the authorities herself, or the king, or the pope? In the 19th and 20th centuries, it is true, some of the apparitions have taken on greater import. At Fatima, Portugal, in 1917, where the Virgin was incensed that a secular government had replaced a government run by the Church, and at Garabandal, Spain, in 1961 to 1965, where the end of the world was threatened unless conservative political and religious doctrines were adopted forthwith. I think I can see many parallels between Marian apparitions and alien abductions, even though the witnesses in the former cases are not promptly taken to heaven and don't have their reproductive organs meddled with. The beings reported are diminutive, most often about 2.5 to 4 feet high. They come from the sky. The content of their communication is, despite its purported celestial origin, mundane. There seems to be a clear connection with sleep and dreams. The witnesses, often females, are troubled about speaking out, especially after encountering ridicule from males in positions of authority. Nevertheless, they persist. They really saw such a thing, they insist. Means of conveying the stories exist. They are eagerly discussed, permitting details to be coordinated even among witnesses who have never met one another. Others present at the time and place of the apparition see nothing unusual. The purported signs or evidence are, without exception, nothing that humans couldn't acquire or fabricate on their own. Indeed, Mary seems unsympathetic to the need for evidence, and occasionally is willing to cure only those who had believed the account of her apparition before she supplied signs. And while there are no therapists per se, the society is suffused by a network of influential parish priests and their hierarchical superiors who have a vested interest in the reality of the visions. In our time, there are still apparitions of Mary and other angels, but also, as summarized by G. Scott Sparrow, a psychotherapist and hypnotist, of Jesus. In I Am With You Always, True Stories of Encounters with Jesus, Bantam 1995, first-hand accounts, some moving, some banal, of such encounters are laid out. Oddly, most of them are straightforward dreams, acknowledged as such, and the ones called visions are said to differ from dreams only because we experience them while we are awake. But for Sparrow, judging something only a dream does not compromise its external reality. For Sparrow, any being you dream of and any incident really exists in the world outside your head. He specifically denies that dreams are purely subjective. If you dreamt it, if it felt good, if it elicited wonder, why then it really happened. There is not a skeptical bone in Sparrow's body. When Jesus tells a conflicted woman in an intolerable marriage to throw the bum out, Sparrow admits that this poses problems for advocates of a scripturally consistent position. In that case, ultimately, perhaps, one could say that virtually all presumed guidance is generated from within. What if someone reported a dream in which Jesus counseled, say, abortion or vengeance? And if indeed somewhere, somehow, we must eventually draw the line and conclude that some dreams are invented by the dreamer, why not all? Why would people invent abduction stories? Why, for that matter, would people appear on TV audience participation programs devoted to sexual humiliation of the guests? The current rage in America's video wasteland. Discovering that you're an alien abductee is at least a break from the routine of everyday life. You gain the attention of peers, therapists, maybe even the media. There is a sense of discovery, exhilaration, awe. What will you remember next? You begin to believe that you may be the harbinger, or even the instrument, of momentous events now rolling towards us. And you don't want to disappoint your therapist. You crave his or her approval. I think there can very well be psychic rewards in becoming an abductee. For comparison, consider product tampering cases, which convey very little of the sense of wonder that surrounds UFOs and alien abductions. Someone claims to find a hypodermic syringe in a popular soft drink can. Understandably, this is upsetting. It's reported in newspapers and especially on television news. Soon, there's a spate, a virtual epidemic of similar reports from all over the country. But it's very hard to see how a hypodermic syringe could get into a can at the factory, and in none of the cases are witnesses present when an intact can is opened and a syringe discovered inside. Slowly, the evidence accumulates that this is a copycat crime. People have only been pretending to find syringes in soft drink cans. Why would anyone do it? What possible motives could they have? Some psychiatrists say that the primary motives are greed. They'll sue the manufacturer for damages, a craving for attention, and a wish to be portrayed as a victim. Note, there are no therapists touting the reality of needles in cans and urging their patients, subtly or directly, to go public with the news. Also, serious penalties are levied for product tampering, and even for falsely alleging that products have been tampered with. In contrast, there are therapists who encourage abductees to tell their stories to mass audiences, and no legal penalties are exacted for falsely claiming you've been abducted by a UFO. Whatever your reason for going down this road, how much more satisfying it must be to convince others that you've been chosen by higher beings for their own enigmatic purpose than that by mere happenstance you found a hypodermic syringe in your cola. Chapter 9. Therapy. It is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories, instead of theories to suit facts. Sherlock Holmes, in Arthur Conan Doyle's A Scandal in Bohemia. 1891. True memories seemed like phantoms, while false memories were so convincing that they replaced reality. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Strange Pilgrims, 1992. John Mack is a Harvard University psychiatrist whom I've known for many years. "Is there anything to this UFO business?" he asked me long ago. "Not much," I replied. "Except, of course, on the psychiatric side." He looked into it, interviewed abductees, and was converted. He now accepts the accounts of abductees at face value. Why? "I wasn't looking for this," he says. "There's nothing in my background that prepared me for the alien abduction story. It's completely persuasive because of the emotional power of these experiences." In his book, Abductions, Mack explicitly proposes the very dangerous doctrine that the power or intensity with which something is felt is a guide to whether it's true. I can personally attest to the emotional power. But aren't powerful emotions a routine component of our dreams? Don't we sometimes awake in stark terror? Doesn't Mack, himself the author of a book on nightmares, know about the emotional power of hallucinations? Some of Mack's patients describe themselves as having hallucinated since childhood. Have the hypnotists and psychotherapists working with abductees made conscientious attempts to steep themselves in the body of knowledge on hallucinations and perceptual malfunctions? Why do they believe these witnesses, but not those who reported, with comparable conviction, encounters with gods, demons, saints, angels, and fairies? And what about those who hear irresistible commands from a voice within? Are all deeply felt stories true? A scientist of my acquaintance says, "If the aliens would only keep all the folks they abduct, our world would be a little saner." But her judgment is too harsh. It doesn't seem to be a matter of sanity. It's something else. The Canadian psychologist Nicholas Spanos and his colleagues concluded that there are no obvious pathologies in those who report being abducted by UFOs. However, intense UFO experiences are more likely to occur in individuals who are disposed to esoteric beliefs in general, and alien beliefs in particular, and who interpret unusual sensory and imaginal experiences in terms of the alien hypothesis. Among UFO believers, those with stronger propensities toward fantasy production were particularly likely to generate such experiences. Moreover, such experiences were likely to be generated and interpreted as real events, rather than imaginings, when they were associated with restricted sensory environments, e.g. experiences that occurred at night and in association with sleep. What a more critical mind might recognize as a hallucination or a dream, a more credulous mind interprets as a glimpse of an elusive but profound external reality. Some alien abduction accounts may conceivably be disguised memories of rape and childhood sexual abuse, with the father, stepfather, uncle, or mother's boyfriend represented as an alien. Surely it's more comforting to believe that an alien abused you than that it was done by someone you trusted and loved. Therapists who take the alien abduction stories at face value deny this, saying they would know if their patients were sexually abused. Some estimates from opinion surveys range as high as 1 in 4 American women and 1 in 6 American men having been sexually abused in childhood, although these estimates are probably too high. It would be astonishing if a significant number of patients who present themselves to alien abduction therapists had not been so abused, perhaps even a larger proportion than in the general population. Both sexual abuse therapists and alien abduction therapists spend months, sometimes years, encouraging their subjects to remember being abused. Their methods are similar, and their goals are in a way the same: to recover painful memories, often of long ago. In both cases, the therapist believes the patient to be suffering from trauma attendant to an event so terrible that it is repressed. I find it striking that alien abduction therapists find so few cases of sexual abuse and vice versa. Those who have in fact been subjected to childhood sexual abuse or incest are, for very understandable reasons, sensitive about anything that seems to minimize or deny their experience. They are angry, and they have every right to be. In the US, at least 1 in 10 women have been raped, almost two-thirds before the age of 18. A recent survey reports that 1/6 of all rape victims reported to police are under the age of 12. And this is the category of rape least likely to be reported. 1/5 of these girls were raped by their fathers. They have been betrayed. I want to be very clear about this. There are many real cases of ghoulish sexual predation by parents, or those acting in the role of parents. Compelling physical evidence, photos, for example, or diaries, or gonorrhea or chlamydia in the child, have in some cases come to light. Abuse of children has been implicated as a major probable cause of social problems. According to one survey, 85% of all violent prison inmates were abused in childhood. Two-thirds of all teenage mothers were raped or sexually abused as children or teenagers. Rape victims are 10 times more likely than other women to use alcohol and other drugs to excess. The problem is real and urgent. Most of these tragic and incontestable cases of childhood sexual abuse, however, have been continuously remembered into adulthood. There is no hidden memory to be retrieved. While there is better reporting today than in the past, there does seem to be a significant increase in cases of child abuse reported each year by hospitals and law enforcement authorities, rising in the United States tenfold to 1.7 million cases between 1967 and 1985. Alcohol and other drugs, as well as economic stresses, are pointed to as the reasons adults are more prone to abuse children today than in the past. Perhaps increasing publicity given to contemporary cases of child abuse emboldens adults to remember and focus on the abuse they once suffered. A century ago, Sigmund Freud introduced the concept of repression, the forgetting of events in order to avoid intense psychic pain, as a coping mechanism essential for mental health. It seemed to emerge especially in patients diagnosed with hysteria, the symptoms of which included hallucinations and paralysis. At first, Freud believed that behind every case of hysteria was a repressed instance of childhood sexual abuse. Eventually, Freud changed his explanation to hysteria being caused by fantasies, not all of them unpleasant, of having been sexually abused as a child. The burden of guilt was shifted from parent to child. Something like this debate rages today. The reason for Freud's change of heart is still being disputed. The explanations ranging from his provoking outrage among his Viennese middle-aged male peers to his recognition that he was taking the stories of hysterics seriously. Instances in which the memory suddenly surfaces, especially at the ministrations of a psychotherapist or hypnotist, and where the first recollections have a ghost or dreamlike quality, are highly questionable. Many such claims of sexual abuse appear to be invented. The Emory University psychologist Ulrich Neisser says, "There is child abuse, and there are such things as repressed memories. But there are also such things as false memories and confabulations, and they are not rare at all. Misrememberings are the rule, not the exception. They occur all the time. They occur even in cases where the subject is absolutely confident, even when the memory is a seemingly unforgettable flashbulb, one of those metaphorical mental photographs. They are still more likely to occur in cases where suggestion is a lively possibility, where memories can be shaped and reshaped to meet the strong interpersonal demands of a therapy session. And once a memory has been reconfigured in this way, it is very, very hard to change. These general principles cannot help us to decide with certainty where the truth lies in any individual case or claim. But on the average, across a large number of such claims, it is pretty obvious where we should place our bets. Misremembering and retrospective reworking of the past are a part of human nature. They go with the territory, and they happen all the time. Survivors of the Nazi death camps provide the clearest imaginable demonstration that even the most monstrous abuse can be carried continuously in human memory. Indeed, the problem for many Holocaust survivors has been to put some emotional distance between themselves and the death camps, to forget. But if in some alternative world of inexpressible evil they were forced to live in Nazi Germany, let's say a thriving post-Hitler nation with its ideology intact, except that it's changed its mind about anti-Semitism, imagine the psychological burden on Holocaust survivors then. Then perhaps they would be able to forget, because remembering would make their current lives unbearable. If there is such a thing as the repression and subsequent recall of ghastly memories, then perhaps it requires two conditions. One, that the abuse actually happened, and two, that the victim was required to pretend for long periods of time that it never happened. The University of California social psychologist Richard Offshey explains. When patients are asked to explain how the memories returned, they report assembling fragments of images, ideas, feelings, and sensations into marginally coherent stories. As the so-called memory work stretches out for months, feelings become vague images become figures, and figures become known persons. Vague discomfort in certain parts of the body is reinterpreted as childhood rape. The original physical sensations, sometimes augmented by hypnosis, are then labeled body memories. There is no conceivable mechanism by which the muscles of the body could store memories. If these methods fail to persuade, the therapist may resort to still more heavy-handed practices. Some patients are recruited into survivor groups in which peer pressure is brought to bear, and they are asked to demonstrate politically correct solidarity by establishing themselves as members of a survivor subculture. A cautious 1993 statement by the American Psychiatric Association accepts the possibility that some of us forget childhood abuse as a means of coping, but warns, "It is not known how to distinguish, with complete accuracy, memories based on true events from those derived from other sources." Repeated questioning may lead individuals to report memories of events that never occurred. It is not known what proportion of adults who report memories of sexual abuse were actually abused. A strong prior belief by the psychiatrist that sexual abuse or other factors are or are not the cause of the patient's problems is likely to interfere with appropriate assessment and treatment. On the one hand, callously to dismiss charges of horrifying sexual abuse can be heartless injustice. On the other hand, to tamper with people's memories, to infuse false stories of childhood abuse, to break up intact families, and even to send innocent parents to prison is also heartless injustice. Skepticism is essential on both sides. Picking our way between these two extremes can be very tricky. Early editions of the influential book by Ellen Bass and Laura Davis, The Courage to Heal, A Guide for Women Survivors of Child Sexual Abuse, Perennial Library, 1988, give illuminating advice to therapists. Believe the survivor. You must believe your client was sexually abused, even if she doubts it herself. Your client needs you to stay steady in the belief that she was abused. Joining a client in doubt would be like joining a suicidal client in her belief that suicide is the best way out. If a client is unsure that she was abused, but thinks she might have been, work as though she was. So far, among the hundreds of women we've talked to, and the hundreds more we've heard about, not one has suspected that she might have been abused, explored it, and determined that she wasn't. But Kenneth V. Lanning, supervisory special agent at the Behavioral Science Instruction and Research Unit of the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, a leading expert on the sexual victimization of children, wonders, are we making up for centuries of denial by now blindly accepting any allegation of child abuse, no matter how absurd or unlikely? I don't care if it's true, replies one California therapist, reported by the Washington Post. What actually happened is irrelevant to me. We all live in a delusion. The existence of any false accusation of childhood sexual abuse, especially those created under the administrations of an authority figure, has, it seems to me, relevance to the alien abduction issue. If some people can, with great passion and conviction, be led to falsely remember being abused by their own parents, might not others, with comparable passion and conviction, be led to falsely remember being abused by aliens? The more I look into claims of alien abduction, the more similar they seem to reports of recovered memories of childhood sexual abuse. And there's a third class of related claims, repressed memories of satanic ritual cults, in which sexual torture, coprophilia, infanticide, and cannibalism are said to be prominently featured. In a survey of 2,700 members of the American Psychological Association, 12% replied that they had treated cases of satanic ritual abuse, while 30% reported cases of abuse done in the name of religion. Something like 10,000 cases are reported annually in the United States in recent years. A significant number of those touting the peril of rampant Satanism in America, including law enforcement officers who organize seminars on the subject, turn out to be Christian fundamentalists. Their sects explicitly require a literal devil to be meddling in everyday human life. The connection is neatly drawn in the saying, "No Satan, no God." Apparently, there is a pervasive police gullibility problem on this matter. Here are some excerpts from FBI expert Lanning's analysis of satanic occult and ritualistic crime, based on bitter experience and published in the October 1989 issue of the professional journal The Police Chief. Almost any discussion of Satanism and witchcraft is interpreted in the light of the religious beliefs of those in the audience. Faith, not logic and reason, governs the religious beliefs of most people. As a result, some normally skeptical law enforcement officers accept the information disseminated at these conferences without critically evaluating it or questioning the sources. For some people, Satanism is any religious belief system other than their own. Lanning then offers a long list of belief systems he has personally heard described as Satanism at such conferences. It includes Roman Catholicism, the Orthodox churches, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, Mormonism, rock and roll music, channeling, astrology, and New Age beliefs in general. Is there not a hint here about how witch hunts and pogroms get started? Within the personal religious belief system of a law enforcement officer, he continues, Christianity may be good and Satanism evil. Under the Constitution, however, both are neutral. This is an important but difficult concept for many law enforcement officers to accept. They are paid to uphold the penal code, not the Ten Commandments. The fact is that more crime and child abuse has been committed by zealots in the name of God, Jesus, and Muhammad than has ever been committed in the name of Satan. Many people don't like that statement, but few can argue with it. Many of those alleging satanic abuse describe grotesque, orgiastic rituals in which infants are murdered and eaten. Such claims have been made about reviled groups by their detractors throughout European history, including the Catiline conspirators in Rome, the Passover blood libel against the Jews, and the Knights Templar as they were being dismantled in 14th century France. Ironically, reports of cannibalistic infanticide and incestuous orgies were among the particulars used by Roman authorities to persecute the early Christians. After all, Jesus himself is quoted as saying, John 6:53, Except ye eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, ye have no life in you. Although the next line makes it clear Jesus is talking about eating his own flesh and drinking his own blood, unsympathetic critics might have misunderstood the Greek Son of Man to mean child or infant. Tertullian and other early church fathers defended themselves against these grotesque accusations as best they could. Today, the lack of corresponding numbers of lost infants and young children in police files is explained by the claim that all over the world, babies are being bred for this purpose. Surely reminiscent of abductee claims that alien-human breeding experiments are rampant. Also similar to the alien abduction paradigm, satanic cult abuse is said to pass down from generation to generation in certain families. To the best of my knowledge, as in the alien abduction paradigm, no physical evidence has ever been offered in a court of law to support such claims. Their emotional power, though, is evident. The mere possibility that such things are going on rouses us mammals to action. When we give credence to satanic ritual, we also raise the social status of those who warn us of the supposed danger. Consider these five cases. 1. Myra Obasi, a Louisiana schoolteacher, was, she and her sisters believed, after consultation with a hoodoo practitioner, possessed by demons. Her nephew's nightmares were part of the evidence. So they left for Dallas, abandoned their five children, and the sisters then gouged out Ms. Obasi's eyes. At the trial, she defended her sisters. They were trying to help her, she said. But hoodoo is not devil worship. It is a cross between Catholicism and African-Haitian nativist religion. 2. Parents beat their child to death because she would not embrace their brand of Christianity. 3. A child molester justifies his acts by reading the Bible to his victims. 4. A 14-year-old boy has his eyeball plucked out of his head in an exorcism ceremony. His assailant is not a Satanist, but a Protestant fundamentalist minister engaged in religious pursuits. 5. A woman thinks her 12-year-old son is possessed by the devil. After an incestuous relationship with him, she decapitates him. But there is no satanic ritual content to the possession. The second and third cases come from FBI files. The last two come from a 1994 study by Dr. Gail Goodman, a psychologist at the University of California, Davis, and her colleagues, done for the National Center on Child Abuse and Neglect. They examined over 12,000 claims of sexual abuse involving satanic ritual cults and could not find a single one that held up to scrutiny. Therapists reported satanic abuse based only on, for instance, patients' disclosure via hypnotherapy or children's fear of satanic symbols. In some cases, diagnosis was made on the basis of behavior common to many children. In only a few cases was physical evidence mentioned, usually scars. But in most cases, the scars were very faint or non-existent. Even when there were scars, it was not determined whether the victims themselves had caused them. This also is very similar to alien abduction cases, as described below. George K. Ganaway, professor of psychiatry at Emory University, proposes that the most common likely cause of cult-related memories may very well turn out to be a mutual deception between the patient and the therapist. One of the most troublesome cases of recovered memory of satanic ritual abuse has been chronicled by Lawrence Wright in a remarkable book, Remembering Satan, Knopf, 1994. It concerns Paul Ingram, a man who may have had his life ruined because he was too gullible, too suggestible, too unpracticed in skepticism. Ingram was, in 1988, chairman of the Republican Party in Olympia, Washington, the chief civil deputy in the local sheriff's department, well-regarded, highly religious, and responsible for warning children in school assemblies of the dangers of drugs. Then came the nightmare moment when one of his daughters, after a highly emotional session at a fundamentalist religious retreat, leveled the first of many charges, each more ghastly than the previous, that Ingram had sexually abused her, impregnated her, tortured her, made her available to other sheriff's deputies, introduced her to satanic rites, dismembered and eaten babies. This had gone on since her childhood, she said, almost to the day she began to remember it all. Ingram could not see why his daughter should lie about this, although he himself had no recollection of it. But police investigators, a consulting psychotherapist, and his minister at the Church of Living Water, all explained that sex offenders often repressed memories of their crimes. Strangely detached, but at the same time eager to cooperate, Ingram tried to recall. After a psychologist employed a close-eye hypnotic technique to induce trance, Ingram began to visualize something similar to what the police were describing. What came to mind were not like real memories, but something like snatches of images in a fog. Every time he produced one, the more so the more odious the content, he was encouraged and reinforced. His pastor assured him that God would permit only genuine memories to surface in his reveries. "Boy, it's almost like I'm making it up," Ingram said, "but I'm not." He suggested that a demon might be responsible. Under the same sort of influences, with the church grapevine circulating the latest horrors that Ingram was confessing, and the police pressuring them, his other children and his wife also began remembering. Prominent citizens were accused of participating in the orgiastic rites. Law enforcement officers elsewhere in America began paying attention. This was only the tip of the iceberg, some said. When Berkeley's Richard Offshey was called in by the prosecution, he performed a control experiment. It was a breath of fresh air. Merely suggesting to Ingram that he had forced his son and daughter to commit incest, and asking him to use the memory recovery technique he had learned, promptly elicited just such a memory. It required no pressure, no intimidation, just the suggestion and the technique were enough. But the alleged participants, who had remembered so much else, denied it ever happened. Confronted with this evidence, Ingram vehemently denied he was making anything up or was influenced by others. His memory of this incident was as clear and real as all his other recollections. One of the daughters described terrible scars on her body from torture and forced abortions. But when she finally received a medical examination, there were no corresponding scars to be seen. The prosecution never tried Ingram on charges of satanic abuse. Ingram hired a lawyer who had never tried a criminal case. On his pastor's advice, he did not even read Offshey's report. It would only confuse him, he was told. He pled guilty to 6 counts of rape, and ultimately was sent to prison. In jail, while awaiting sentencing, away from his daughters, his police colleagues, and his pastor, he reconsidered. He asked to withdraw his guilty plea. His memories had been coerced. He had not distinguished real memories from a kind of fantasy. His plea was rejected. He is serving a 20-year sentence. If it was the 16th century instead of the 20th, perhaps the whole family would have been burned at the stake, along with a good fraction of the leading citizens of Olympia, Washington. The existence of a highly skeptical FBI report on the general subject of satanic abuse, Kenneth V. Lanning, Investigator's Guide to Allegations of Ritual Child Abuse, January 1992, is widely ignored by enthusiasts. Likewise, a 1994 study by the British Department of Health into claims of satanic abuse there concluded that of 84 alleged instances, not one stood up to scrutiny. What then is all the furor about? A study explains. The Evangelical Christian Campaign against new religious movements has been a powerful influence encouraging the identification of satanic abuse. Equally, if not more important in spreading the idea of satanic abuse in Britain, are the specialists, American and British, They may have few or even no qualifications as professionals, but attribute their expertise to experience of cases. Those convinced that devil cults represent a serious danger to our society tend to be impatient with skeptics. Consider this analysis by Corydon Hammond, PhD, past president of the American Society for Clinical Hypnosis. I will suggest to you that these people, skeptics, are either 1. Naive and of limited clinical experience, 2. Have the kind of naivete that people have of the Holocaust, or they're just such intellectualizers and skeptics that they'll doubt everything, or 3. They're cult people themselves. And I can assure that there are people who are in that position. There are people who are physicians, who are mental health professionals, who are in the cults, who are raising transgenerational cults. I think the research is real clear. We got 3 studies. One found 25%, one found 20% of outpatient multiples, multiple personality disorders, appear to be cult abuse victims. And another, on a specialized inpatient unit, found 50%. In some of his statements, he seems to believe that satanic Nazi mind control experiments have been performed by the CIA on tens of thousands of unsuspecting American citizens. The overarching motive, Hammond believes, is to create a satanic order that will rule the world. In all 3 classes of recovered memories, there are specialists: alien abduction specialists, satanic cult specialists, and specialists in recalling repressed memories of childhood sexual abuse. As is common in mental health practice, patients select or are referred to a therapist whose specialty seems relevant to their complaint. In all 3 classes, the therapist helps to draw forth images of events alleged to have occurred long ago, in some cases from decades past. In all 3, therapists are profoundly moved by the unmistakably genuine agony of their patients. In all 3, at least some therapists are known to ask leading questions, which are virtually orders by authority figures to suggestible patients insisting that they remember. I almost wrote confess. In all 3, there are networks of therapists who trade client histories and therapeutic methods. In all 3, practitioners feel the necessity of defending their practice against more skeptical colleagues. In all 3, the iatrogenic hypothesis is given short shrift. In all 3, the majority of those who report abuse are women. And in all 3 classes, with the exceptions mentioned, there is no physical evidence. So it's hard not to wonder whether alien abductions might be part of some larger picture. What could this larger picture be? I posed this question to Dr. Fred H. Frankel, professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, chief of psychiatry at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, and a leading expert on hypnosis. His answer: if alien abductions are part of a larger picture, what indeed is the larger picture? I fear to rush in where angels fear to tread. However, the factors you outline all feed what was described at the turn of the century as hysteria. The term, sadly, became so widely used that our contemporaries, in their dubious wisdom, not only dropped it, but also lost sight of the phenomena it represented: high levels of suggestibility, imaginal capacity, sensitivity to contextual cues and expectations, and the element of contagion. Little of all this seems to be appreciated by a large number of practicing clinicians. In exact parallel to regressing people so they supposedly retrieve forgotten memories of past lives, Frankel notes that therapists can as readily progress people under hypnosis so they can remember their futures. This elicits the same emotive intensity as in regression or in max abductee hypnosis. These people are not out to deceive the therapist. They deceive themselves, Frankel says. They cannot distinguish their confabulations from their experiences. If we fail to cope, if we're saddled with a burden of guilt for not having made more of ourselves, wouldn't we welcome the professional opinion of a therapist with a diploma on the wall that it's not our fault, that we're off the hook, that Satanists or sexual abusers or aliens from another planet are the responsible parties? Wouldn't we be willing to pay good money for this reassurance? And wouldn't we resist smart-ass skeptics telling us that it's all in our heads, or that it's implanted by the very therapists who have made us happier about ourselves? How much training in scientific method and skeptical scrutiny, in statistics, or even in human fallibility, have these therapists received? Psychoanalysis is not a very self-critical profession, but at least many of its practitioners have MD degrees. Most medical curricula include significant exposure to scientific results and methods. But many of those dealing with abuse cases seem to have at best a casual acquaintance with science. Mental health providers in America are more likely by about 2 to 1 to be social workers than either psychiatrists or PhD psychologists. Most of these therapists contend that their responsibility is to support their patients, not to question, to be skeptical, or to raise doubts. Whatever is presented, no matter how bizarre, is accepted. Sometimes the prompting by therapists is not at all subtle. Here, from the False Memory Syndrome Foundation's FMS newsletter, Volume 4, Number 4, Page 3, 1995, is a hardly atypical report. My former therapist has testified that he still believes that my mother is a Satanist, and that my father molested me. It was my therapist's delusional belief system and techniques involving suggestion and persuasion that led me to believe the lies were memories. When I doubted the reality of the memories, he insisted they were true. Not only did he insist they were true, he informed me that in order to get well, I must not only accept them as real, but remember them all. In a 1991 case in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, a teenager, Nicole Althaus, encouraged by a teacher and a social worker, accused her father of having sexually abused her, resulting in his arrest. Nicole also reported that she had given birth to 3 children, whom her relatives had killed, that she had been raped in a crowded restaurant, and that her grandmother flew about on a broom. Nicole recanted her allegations the following year, and all charges against her father were dropped. Nicole and her parents brought a civil suit against the therapist and the psychiatric clinic to whom Nicole had been referred shortly after she began making the accusations. The jury found that the doctor and the clinic had been negligent and awarded almost $250,000 to Nicole and her parents. There are increasing numbers of cases of this sort. Might the competition among therapists for patients and the obvious financial interests of therapists in prolonged therapy make them less likely to offend patients by evincing some skepticism about their stories? How aware are they of the dilemma of a naive patient walking into a professional office and being told that the insomnia or obesity is due, in increasing order of bizarreness, to wholly forgotten parental abuse, satanic ritual, or alien abduction? While there are ethical and other constraints, we need something like a control experiment. Perhaps the same patient sent to specialists in all 3 fields. Does any of them say, no, your problem isn't due to forgotten childhood abuse, or forgotten satanic ritual, or alien abduction, as appropriate? How many of them say there's a much more prosaic explanation? Instead, Mac goes so far as to tell one of his patients admiringly and reassuringly that he is on a hero's journey. 1 group of abductees, each having a separate but similar experience, writes, "Several of us had finally summoned enough courage to present our experiences to professional counselors, only to have them nervously avoid the subject, raise an eyebrow in silence, or interpret the experience as a dream or waking hallucination, and patronizingly reassure us that such things happen to people. But don't worry, you're basically mentally sound. Great, we're not crazy. But if we take our experiences seriously, then we might become crazy." With enormous relief, they found a sympathetic therapist who not only accepted their stories at face value, but was full of stories of alien bodies and high-level government cover-up of UFOs. A typical UFO therapist finds his subjects in three ways. They write letters to him at an address given in the back of his books. They are referred to him by other therapists, mainly those who also specialize in alien abductions. Or they come up to him after he presents a lecture. I wonder if any patient arrives at his portal wholly ignorant of popular abduction accounts and the therapist's own methods and beliefs. Before any words are exchanged, they know a great deal about one another. Another prominent therapist gives his patients his own articles on alien abductions to help them remember their experiences. He is gratified when what they eventually recall under hypnosis resembles what he describes in his papers. The similarity of the cases is one of his chief reasons for believing that abductions really occur. A leading UFO scholar comments that when the hypnotist does not have an adequate knowledge of the subject, of alien abductions, the true nature of the abduction may never be revealed. Can we discern in this remark how the patient might be led without the therapist realizing that he is leading? Sometimes when falling asleep, we have the sense of toppling from a height, and our limbs suddenly flail on their own. The startle reflex, it is called. Perhaps it's left over from when our ancestors slept in trees. Why should we imagine we recollect, a wonderful word, any better than we know when we're on firm ground? Why should we suppose that, of the vast treasure of memories stored in our heads, none of it could have been implanted after the event? By how a question is phrased when we're in a suggestible frame of mind, by the pleasure of telling or hearing a good story, by confusion with something we once read or overheard.